Yeah, again, I just wanted to just take a few more things about Torah and Derech Eretz and Repurchase philosophy. Again, those of you that are familiar with Washington Heights and even the Yekesha communities in Eretz Yisrael know that many of them are full-time kollel. Many of them are integrated into what you might call the Haredi or the Yeshivish communities. They felt, as was the shita of many gedolim in Europe, that Rav Hirsch's hadracha was hayrat shah, and it was not intended to be a permanent lechatchila. On the other hand, there are some old theoreticians of the movement, who are talmidei chachamim themselves, who feel that this is what you call revisionist history, which they're going backwards and reading into Rav Hirsch what is not his kavana. But again, if you want to be a little docistic, you have to be mechalik between what Rav Hirsch held and what other Gedolim said would be the proper application of Rav Hirsch's shita. Meaning to say, when Gedolim say that Torah Derech Eretz is a b'diavad, not l'chatchila, they're not necessarily being mefarish Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch taka may have held l'chatchila l'gamri, but they're saying l'halacha, so to speak, we only paskin b'diavad. And so they're not, it's not revisionism. Revisionism would be when you attempt to redefine that man d'amar not in accordance with his shita. If you simply say, we don't paskin like that shita, that's not revision. Right, as they say, yesh eimrim mikan, yesh eimrim mikan, this is an old debate. I'll give you a specific example of it in a minute. Rav Hirsch, as they say, Rav Hirsch in his lifetime was most meforsome, actually, not even for Torah Derech Eretz. He was most meforsome as a community builder, as the one who fought both legally and religiously for religious communities to be separate from reform. He built mostos, he built schools, he built yeshivas, he built mikvos. He was a builder. He was a builder, a community organizer, a person who created kehilas that started off with 10 people and wound up with, 10,000 people. This is what he was known for, but as we know him, we know him, of course, primarily for his ksavim, and it's worthwhile to talk about his writings a little bit. Svarim are not bestsellers. Very few Svarim are bestsellers. The Piskei Tshuva is a bestseller, the one on the Mishnah Berurah, the 6 volumes, that's a bestseller, but most Svarim are not, which is why, there's a website, I don't know if you've seen this, it's an interesting website, HebrewBooks.org, assuming you're allowed to use the internet, I'm not posking that. But HebrewBooks.org has 50,000, more than 50,000 Svarim, Pashut, that were scanned in. They're Pashut online, that whenever I give a share. I basically, if I'm doing a Ksais or just a Svekas or anything else, I just don't have to use the Xerox machine anymore. Just do that and print whatever number of copies and the like. So I notice, they always send you a message when new Svarim are scanned in. So I see now it's all the new Svarim. People are just giving, Tufshinayin Aleph, Tufshinayin Beis. So I'm wondering, why are Mechagrim just giving, do they get paid for this? They're just giving their Sefer for free, basically. And the answer is, Svarim don't make money. So if a Mechagrim wants people to at least read the Sefer, he'd rather actually give. So the emphasis is, Svarim unfortunately do not make a lot of money. You're not going to get rich by Svarim. But Rav Hirsch's books were actually relative bestsellers in the time. And the first book that he wrote really made his reputation. He wrote it as a young man. And this is the book that's known as the 19 Letters of Ben Uziel. And the way it works is, it is a letter written by a fellow. Again, Rav Hirsch wrote both sides of the letter. It was written anonymously. But in other words, he didn't say who wrote it. But letter number one is by a person who was a Jew, but he left orthodoxy, he left halacha, because he finds it old-fashioned, he finds it stultifying, he finds it without taste, without aesthetics, without beauty, and he writes about the beauties of Shakespeare and the profundity of Kant, and he says, how can a dirty, filthy Beis Medrash, where people are just reading the same thing over and over again, how can it compare? And it's really, the first letter is mamish, an attack on Yiddishkeit, kind of reverse put into this mouth, all of the tinnitus that the young intellectuals of Germany had. and why they were either nimshach to reform or haskalah or Christianity or just left everything. And the remaining 18 letters are his old friend, who's the rabbi, responding and trying to explain Yiddishkeit and explaining Ikrei Amuna and the beauty of Torah, and that's where he first articulated Torah and Derech Eretz. Now, the 19 letters was kind of a shocker, because here you have an assimilated German Jew, typically a young fellow in his 20s. He picks up a book written by a so-called Orthodox rabbi, and the Orthodox rabbi kind of is maida to all of the problems. In other words, he addresses all of the kashas, all of the shilas, all of the stiras, all of the emotional, visceral reactions. That really grabs you. I mean, I remember the first time I saw it like in seventh grade. So, but I mean, you know, the first letter really grabs you because he seems to set up such a bitter attack on Yiddishkeit, which he then tries to explain. Now the MS is, in that Mahalech, there's a tremendous sakana. If you're not Rav Hirsch, don't try to do Kirov that way. Because sometimes you're setting up kashas that might be stronger than the way you're able to explain the answers. You know, because he really went all out and, you know, he put into the mouth of his antagonist a very bitter attack on all aspects of Yiddishkeit. And this was written in German, of course, and it was a bestseller. But there's an interesting little history about this to show that even Rav Hirsch was at the mercy of the economics of publishing. Rav Hirsch Lechatchila wanted to write a whole big book explaining the whole philosophy of mitzvahs in German, the book that later became Chayrith. The publisher said, well, it costs a lot of money to print a book. I don't want to commit ourselves to printing a big book until we see that, you know, you write things that sell. So why don't you write a small book first? Let's see how it sells. And if it's successful, we'll finance Chayrith. So the 19 letters was Rav Hirsch's Hakdama to Chayrev, which was a bestseller in Memela. He was able to write Chayrev. So the 19 letters was a very big one. By the way, the 19 letters, which obviously is a great, great defense of Yiddishkeit in the modern era, in itself has some controversies. Number one, it articulated Torah Derech Eretz, which was not so makubal in Eastern Europe. Number two, Rav Hirsch had some controversial things about Agadita, where Rav Hirsch writes there that when some of the people tine it, oh, Agadita has Baba Mises and things that are not rational. Rav Hirsch said to some degree, Enochinami says Agadita is not part of the Messiah. Now, as I mentioned, the Maral had a different Mahalach. The way the Maral addressed it is part of the Messiah, but it's symbolic of deeper spiritual truths. Rav Hirsch seem to say that it's Bechlal not part of the Messiah, and one is not Mechuyev necessarily to be Mekabel. Again, that's not a Shita that everybody is Mekabel. And Rav Hirsch also had some negative thoughts about Kabbalah, because he said that although Kabbalah was the deepest part of the Torah, he was Makir that, but he said in the hands of people who didn't understand it, it sometimes was degenerated into cheap superstition. Now you see, Rav Hirsch is addressing people who were very, very rational, or they prided themselves on their rationality and their philosophy. And the Mela, he had to say, all of those elements in Yiddishkeit that don't seem to work with logic, Rav Hirsch tried to downgrade a little bit. Again, to a large degree, I think what he's saying is MS in that sense, that when sod is simply used for segulas or for magic or for abracadabra in economic, the attacker might be something wrong there. But be it as it may, it was a bit of a controversial book. But Rav Yisrael Salanter, who in the end of his life, you'll remember, moved to Germany, very much, he taught himself German, and he read the book, and he very much wanted it to be translated in Hebrew or Yiddish for the people in Russia and Poland. He was very machshiv that particular book. The 19 letters was a precursor to a much larger work, which is called Chayrev, again written in German. They must have Chayrev here in the English library. Chayrev is a very, very interesting book as well. He goes through all of the mitzvos, and he groups them together in Eidos, Chukim, Mishpatim. He uses these different categories based on the Pesukim. and he's masber, gives some of the halachas, but mainly he's masber the philosophy and the tamei ha-mitzvahs. And again, his who was his target audience? His target audience for that were largely Jews who were either on the verge of assimilation or who had assimilated, to give them a tam and an understanding of the beauty of Yiddishkeit. And once again, it was very successful. And the truth is, Chayrev, even today, is a book that many people find very satisfying. But I wanted to mention about the 19 letters. A few years ago, that's probably maybe 15 years ago already, Feldheim, the publisher, issued a new edition of the 19 letters, of course translated in English, but with annotations by Rabbi Yosef Elias. Rabbi Yosef Elias, for many years, was the principal of the Breuer's high schools in Washington Heights. So he's considered to be like the big bucky on Rav Shimshon Fall Hirsch. And Rabbi Elias wrote long footnotes, long annotations on Rav Hirsch. And everything Rav Elias did was to kind of reconcile, be miyashiv Rav Hirsch, with the dais and the hashkafa of the yeshiva world. So see, what I was saying? So every time Rav Hirsch talked about the beauties of poetry and the need to understand science and the need to broaden your horizons, Rav Elias would always say, but of course, for Shteta, this was a harasha for Germany, and you know, it doesn't apply today, etc. So I remember that when that came out, there were some Zakenim, Talmidei Chachamim of the other Shita, who were attacking him. They said, listen, it's one thing if you just want to say there are other Shitas, but don't try to be Mefarish Rav Hirsch that way. So, as I say, this is actually a live machlekes that's still going on as to what is the legacy, what is the Yerusha, what is the Yesod of Rav Hirsch. So we have the 19 letters, we have Chayrev, and then there are the Perish Al Chumash, which is very, very interesting. The Rav Shimshon Fall Hirsch's Perish Al Chumash, by the way, is Megala to us if you learn it, particularly the Parshias dealing with halachas like Mishpatim and the like. You see his Bekiyas and his Yediyah in Shas Rishenim and Achreinim. He's often Mefalpel. Derech Agav, they'll say a number of Chidushim, a number of Ha'aris. In fact, in the standard English translation, they don't even translate that. Sometimes you're reading a Rishtikel of Rav Hirsch, and there's a bunch of Hebrew lines that nobody even bothered to translate. Usually that's kind of a Chiddush in Gemara, so they figured who was ever using the English probably wouldn't understand it anyway, so they just leave it untranslated. Rav Hirsch's Perush al Torah, which was of course also written in German with these Hebrew notes, was again a tremendously important sefer in many, many ways. And Biakifin, indirectly, it had a big, big role in the establishment of the Beis Yaakov system. You know, the Beis Yaakov system, which is a big chiddush, right? This was the idea of creating organized schools at an advanced level for women. And even though the Gemara says, if you're melamed, bitay Torah, shebal peh, it's tiflus, it's something foolish, and the Rambam says one should not teach, you know, a woman Torah shebal peh, but Sarah Schneer, who was a seamstress in Krakow, started schools, and she had naskama of the Belzer Rebbe and the Ger Rebbe and the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim has a long ha'ara that says that when the home was more hermetically sealed and the secular environments weren't so negative and they weren't so powerful, so whatever a woman needed, she got from her family, she got from her home, and there was no reason to get her involved in formal education. But now it's Eis Lasei Slashem, the Chafetz Chaim said, that women were so exposed to the ruach of the dairus that one needs hadracha, one needs chinuch, and memela fakert, the Chafetz Chaim said, would be usur not to be melamed bita tairin. Now, what you learn, how you learn, what subjects, that's a separate dian. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time. But once again, many gedolim have said later, when people were talking about who was the greatest marbitz tairin of the 20th century, so Rabbi Cheskel Sarnad, the Rashiv of Chevron, said Sarah Schneer was the greatest Marbitz Torah, because of the Beis Yaakov system that she established, which is all over the world now. And whether it's called Beis Yaakov or Beis Sarah or Beis Rivka, whatever it's called, it's all from her Yisrael. She created this. that created the whole hashgafa of women helping their husbands to learn, to be machshiv Torah, etc., and the like. So her zchus is tremendous. Now, Sarah Schneer did not go to Beis Yaakov because she invented Beis Yaakov, right? So, where did Sarah Schneer get her iris, her interest, her understanding how important Torah would be for women as well? Well, her main mucker, which, you know, what she read was Rav Shimshon Val Hirsch's Peirush al HaTorah. So although they never met, I mean, she didn't know Rav Shimshon Val Hirsch, but this was really perhaps the most important spiritual influence on her, was reading Rav Hirsch in the German and seeing how much it helped her, and the Mela she created. She had this idea that women, Pashut, needed this type of school system. It's interesting, you may know that they recently retranslated, and Ezra first wrote it in German, and for many, many years the standard translation was by his grandson, one of his grandsons, Yitzchak Levy, and if you've used it, you may have felt perhaps it's a little difficult to read. And part of why it's very difficult to read is that Yitzchak Levy was a very literal translator, and therefore he translated literally from German to English. Now, languages have different syntax and rhythm. German is a very heavy, ponderous language. You know, sentences tend to be 800 words, etc. Just goes on and on and on. It's also very flowery. First of all, that was the 19th century style anyway, and 19th century German was very, very flowery, repetitive, verbose, you know, same things in all sorts of fancy ways, and the Isaac Levy translation was exactly what Rav Hirsch's style was, which in the 19th century was a perfect style. They loved it in Germany, but for the American reader that has less Litzfleisch, right, we're less, you know, we want something a little faster, so to speak, it was a hard, little hard sometimes. So, interestingly enough, they just retranslated the Peirush, and you'll actually see it's more American style now. It's less literal, but it gives you the title in a way that's easier. So if you were turned off, perhaps, by the older version, you might want to try it again and see, because now it's a little more matim to the Kore. And if you're going to say, well, if I first wrote it that way, what gives you rishus like to write it differently? Well, the Rambam himself, when the Rambam wrote wrote many svarim in Arabic, Peirush HaMishnayos and Moreh Nevuchim. The Rambam told his translators, Yehuda ibn Tibbon, do not translate literally. Because when you translate literally, in the new language you're translating, you're going to lose the meaning. Right? So the Rambam himself says translators should not translate exactly literally. Yeah.
Who did the Hebrew
translation? The original, Bracious was already translated in like the 1890s, right after Rav Hirsch was Nifter. It was by a Litvisher, Rav Aronson was his name, Rav Aronson. But I think he died before he did the rest. And the rest was translated much, much later. I think in the 1940s or 50s, I don't know who did it. And I don't even know off the top of my head if they retranslated Bracious or they were Semich on the first Bracious. Part of the problem with these translators is that sometimes they translate from the English, meaning it's a problem that they, in other words, sometimes the translator doesn't know German, so the Hebrew translation is from a translation, which is not always that good. It's already cliché-y. You know, normally a translator should be able to go back to the original language in which something was written. Now, some other things of Rav Hirsch were published after he died. The Peirush on Chumash was published in his lifetime. Tehillim, which is quite... One other thing about the Chumash that's interesting, that people don't pay attention to, but it's actually very interesting. Everybody thinks that what Rav Hirsch added, so to speak, is the Peirush, but the MSS, he also translated the Torah. And his translation itself is also very interesting, and hopefully in the English they pick up the way he's translating the Pesukim in German. So the translation itself is very kedai. And in Tehillim, you'll see this even more so. That it's not just the Peirush that's very, very unique, but the translation of the Pesukim is very, very significant. The translator of Tehillim was not the grandson who did the Chumash. She was a woman, Gertrude Hirschler, a very, very, knowledgeable and fine translator, and that is much more literary and elegant. It's actually, the Hillel translation is better than the one on the Chumash. And then they did the Siddur. Again, this is after his death. They did a Siddur in German, and then they translated in English. And finally, there are like 8 or 9 volumes of collected writings. And this came from Rav Hirsch, submitted many, many articles to magazines, to journals, etc., some of which he was the editor, some of which he was just a contributor, and all sorts of things. And these were gathered together in separate books called collected writings. Again, all of this in German, Gesammelte Schriften, which is collected writings. These are very important things. These are essays on Ostritz, defending his position on why Frum Yidden had to have separate Gehillas, on symbolism. He goes through everything in the Mishkan to show, and the Beis Hamikdash, to show what spiritual ideas they represent. He shows how the brachas of Shmona Esrei correspond to the Avodah in the Beis Hamikdash, right? Because Tfilas B'makom Korbanah, so he shows how the different brachas are connected, different Avodos in the Beis Hamikdash. Tzitzis, Tfilin, Mila. This was a series he was writing on the symbolic meanings of mitzvahs. Some have said that a lot of his yesaitis are in fact based on Zohar. So Hagam, that in the 19 letters he kind of downplayed Kabbalah, he in fact himself used Kabbalah and tried to bring it into a symbolism of mitzvahs. So B'sach HaKol, he was obviously a great Anadam Gadol, Ma'id, a very, very great person, a person that the Gedalim of the yeshiva world gave credit for being Matzil German Jewry from Pasha total assimilation. But as I say, some of his shitas, they're still a machlokes as to whether they're l'chatchila, whether we should encourage it, or whether we simply say, yeah, if you're doing it, you know, so you can still remain from. But as I say, as you will often see with great gedolim, there is a contested legacy. In other words, there's a machlokes exactly. What is the hadracha that you should take from that shita? Do you want to say?
Just to clarify, considering what he was saying at the time he was saying it, that there wasn't more, the accusations that were formed, things he was saying seemed very suspicious to, and he had a sensitivity there. So that it just seems that Apia Roth was accepted to be a gadol. Isn't that surprising?
Well, you know, no, it is a funny thing, because for example, my first reaction I was going to say, but then I rethought it, but my first reaction was, well, maybe in those days people were willing to hear different shitas more than today. Today, you know, he probably would have been called an apikoros or whatever it is. There they were willing to live with him. On the other hand, you're raising an interesting question, because when Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was miyasid the Musar shita, there was taka, a much, much bitter denunciations, and he was attacked. He was attacked, and people were talking about this as they didn't call him a kifer, they didn't go that far, but they said, you know, this is not the Derech HaTorah, and you're changing things. And at first you didn't find it. Now, I think the idea basically was, the nafkamina was, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was doing his stuff in Lithuania, Refersh was doing his stuff in Germany, so the attitude was by many Gedalim, whatever works, meaning to say, Germany was in such a matzav, mamish, I mean, that's the Hirasha, that they were makir that, okay, this is what you need, this is what you need. It was a spiritual pikuach nefesh. Masha Enkein, they held in Lita, you know, we have Stark Torah, we have Stark Yeshivas, we have Stark B'nai Torah, we don't have to do new things that might undermine or give in to the Haskalah. But I do want to remind you that when there was some thought about creating, you know, Torim Derech Eretz Mostos in Eretz Yisrael, you know, Gedolim were very much against it, right? So as long as you kept it in Germany, it was considered to be Baruch Hashem, that's fine. Give them what they need, as it were. Yeah.
See the beginning of the Talmud Torahs that we have today? In Europe and England and USA, right?
You're talking about the afternoon?
The afternoon, yeah. The two, 3 hours of maths and English.
Well, that was connected. I mean, the truth is, Rav Hirsch had everything under the same roof, the secular and the, and that. But, the Talmud Torahs are connected to Torah and Derech Eretz in that way, because that was the idea of combining a Jewish Chinuch with some type of secular with some type of secular studies and the like. Okay.
You were early in the Halfway,
say again?
People that can't trace back to the days of Bassem Saif or something like that. A bit before that, why are they arguing in Rehersh capital? Because they know what happened before that. You said already that people used to be always in Parnassus before Rehersh. So what?
Well, Parnassus, obviously most of Klal Yisrael, for most of history, were Isaac and Parnassus, right? We like to talk about the golden days of Europe. The emphasis is most Jews in Europe were working, right? They were not sitting in Kailo. But the concept would be that within the Maestas of Chinuch, you didn't introduce secular Chachma and the like. Rav Hirsch was one of the first who institutionalized it. And that created a notion of watering down what a Torah chinuch was.
They were having pure Torah chinuch before.
Right. That's correct. Okay. Just see if what else I wanted to say about this. There's a remez, in the Chazon Ish's Sefer, Emunah u'Bitachon. There are certain ramazim. The Chazon Ish is meramis to certain things. I think I'd mentioned to you before that Emunah u'Bitachon in many ways was a subtle attack on some of the extremes of Mussar. In fact, the famous thought the Chazon Ish develops that Gamzu L'Taiva does not mean things will have a happy ending. We sometimes say Gamzu L'Taiva means as long as I believe in Hashem, the person who is sick is going to get better. I'm going to get the job I need. So the Chazon Ish Taina is, that's not Gamzu L'Taiva. Gamzu L'Taiva does not mean your tzara is going to end. Gamzu L'Taiva means whatever happens is the Ratzon Hashem. And you have to be makabel it as such. But the Chazon Ish said, to believe that everything's going to have a happy ending, it's almost pashut, is naivete. Now, you have to understand that who he was addressing was the Shita of the Altar of Nevardik, who Taka believed that Altar of Nevardik did have such a Shita, that if you're Marbe and you're Mechazik V'Emunah, that Emunah is going to be Payo Yeshua. And the Chazon Ish felt that v'shteitzach maminim believe in the kayach atfila, and that's not the question. But the Chazon Ish said to make it such a vadai. Like the Gemara itself has a lesson. The Gemara says that iyan tfila is one of those devarim that bring you to ke'ev leiv. The Gemara in Shabbos, which is very obscure Gemara. It says iyan tfila brings you to ke'ev leiv. So Taisus asks the Kasha, whatever that means, that implies that something called Iyan Tefillah is no good, and yet we find Iyan Tefillah are the Dvarim She'ein Lehem Shiur, that the more you do it, the better. So is it, whatever it is it good or is it bad? So Taisus explains, Taisus is Masber. Iyan Tefillah means, I'm deeply Mechavein in Marbe B'Tefillah. So that's good. Iyan Tefillah is a Gavaldi Gazach. You daven with Kavana. But the Iyan Tefillah that's no good is the sense that as long as I daven as hard as I can, I'm guaranteed Hashem is going to give me what I want. On that, the Gemara says, you're going to be disappointed. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam has cheshbonos. And you can't make the assumption, as long as I really mean it, I'll get it. So the Chazon Ish was trying to negate that, because the Chazon Ish felt that fakert, as the Gemara says, that shita brings a person to ke'ev leiv, and chas v'shalom, it could lead a person to apikorsis. I've heard people say, I prayed for something with all my heart, and Hashem didn't give it to me, so I can't be a maimon. I've heard people say, I can't be a maimon anymore. I was told if I pray to Hashem with all my heart, I'll get something. So the Chazon Ish was b'davka bevorning. So I want to point out that k'shem that he was bevorning the Shita of Nevardik, There's a one remez in Emunah Ubitachon to the sheet of Torium Derecheretz, although he doesn't identify. He doesn't identify who he's talking about. But he says the following: the Chazon Ish Tainis in one place that B'derech Klal, it's not Shayach Midas Taivais and even Daikonus in Halacha without Amelus B'Torah Shebal Peh. Right, the Bali Musar were saying, work on your midas. Tyrim Derech Eretz was saying, be medayak in mitzvahs. But the Chazon Ish felt both of these netiyas were not always emphasizing Amelus B'Torah. And the Chazon Ish Tain, actually he's dealing with Musar and Tide at the same time. Right, the Chazon Ish was Taining, without Amelus B'Torah, a person doesn't have the Yiras Shamayim to be medayik and halacha. And the Chazon Ish gives a lot of interesting examples. He gives an example like this. He says, let's say a person, you know, is a Baal Chesed who loves to have orchim. And he invited someone for Shabbos. And he made the table in a fancy meal. But Nebuch, he realizes, just right before the guest comes, the lights in the house, the Shabbos lights, you know, the lights in the house went off. And he's going to be embarrassed. The guest is going to come into a totally dark house. So the Chazon Ish says, his chesed and his midas are not really going to be matzil him from a real desire to, okay, just one time in my life I light a candle on Shabbos. This is the Chazon Ish says. I mean, I'm doing it for achnasas orchim. I'm doing it, you know, to make him feel good. I'm doing it so I shouldn't be embarrassed, although he's probably not going to give him that reason. So the Chazon Ish says, unless you have the Yiras Hashem that comes from Amelus B'Torah, at some point you're going to reach a breaking point. At some point, the situation you face is going to be so hard that you're going to be nichshel. Only once. Then, of course, Avera Gerera Savera. But then he says as a footnote, it could be in rare cases a person who was morgul in mitzvahs from the time he was a young child to follow halacha exactly, perhaps in rare cases he could be strong enough to withstand nisayon, but that's not common. So the chaykrim of the Chazon Ish say he's being meramez to some yidden he knew from Germany, who were not b'nai Torah, they were not people who learned, but they were yucky, so to speak. They were so stark and so firm that kol rucha shabiyalim would not blow them away. But the Chazon Ish is saying, the bederach klal, it doesn't work that way. Without a foundation of Torah, you get blown away. And here I'll tell you a word from the Chafetz Chaim, which was not specifically addressed to Tide, but After he had it in mind, Tide is Torah Derech Eretz. This is a word from Chafetz Chaim by the Sora Shel Esav. Right, state when Yaakov Avinu is about to meet Esav, so the night before he has a big struggle with the Malach, which Chazal say is Sora Shel Esav. And at the end of the night, Yaakov is limping because the angel hit him on the thigh, etc. And that's why we don't eat the Gid Hanosha. So the Chafetz Chaim says, how come we find that only Yaakov Avinu is fighting this kayach that tries to destroy him? Why don't we find a similar kayach trying to destroy Avram, trying to destroy Yitzchak? You don't find Avram, right, there in Midrashim, but in the Chumash at least, you don't find Avram struggling with some kayach that wants to be mevatel him, and Yitzchak. So here's what the Chafetz Chaim says, you know, it's Yadua, that Pirkei Avos says, Al Shleshu Dvarim Ha'ilim Ha'imeit, Al HaTaira V'Al HaVeida V'Al Gemilas Chasadim. So all the Svarim tell us that Avraham is the Yisayit of Gemilas Chasad, Yitzchak, who is a Korban, is the Yisayit of Aveida, and Yaakov Avinu, who learned 14 years by Shem V'Aver, is the Kayach HaTaira. So the Chafetz Chaim says like this, the kayachas of Tuma, the klipais, the chitzainias, whatever you want to call them, the kayachara, is perfectly happy to let Avram do his chesed, and Yitzchak do his avaida. Because hagam that they're doing mitzvahs, But without Limud HaTorah, it's not going to have a Kiyam. So they'll do mitzvahs for a few generations. It's going to die out. So the HaTorah says, I don't have to fight them. I'll let them do what they do without Torah, because there'll be no Hamshacha. Aber says the Chafetz Chaim, Yaakov represents the Kayach of Torah. With Torah, there will be a Hamshacha. That, the Kayach of Tumah, has to be Mevatel. And that's what the Chafetz Chaim says. Hagam that Avada, Kwal Yisrael, we need Torah, Avada, and Gemilas Chasadah. But the Chafetz Chaim says, without Torah, the Avada and the Gemilas Chasadim itself is going to be short-lived and it's going to disappear. Now, the truth of the matter is, even historically, this is 100% accurate. Even if you look at American Jewry, if you know the history of Judaism in America, by and large, when the first wave, I mean, there have been Jews since 1700s, 1600s, but you know, the big waves of European Jews were first German Jews, and they came in the 1830s, 40s, 50s. They were rich, and they established themselves almost totally reformed. There were certainly no yeshivas, almost no, even afternoon Talmud Torah is almost nothing. And they established, what did they establish? They established magnificent social welfare institutions, great Jewish hospitals, fraternal lodges, ways of, networking and the like. So they were Isaac in Chesed. And what happened was their descendants almost totally became not Jewish. And then the next wave, which were more Polish, Eastern European Yidden, which, by the way, the Germans didn't even want to associate with. They were embarrassed by the less educated, primitive Jews. In fact, that in many Jewish cities, as if this is a big thing, they had to establish two different country clubs. Country club is a big thing. Go play golf. There's the German Jewish country club, and then there was the country club that accepted, Polish Jews, Eisjiden, East Jews, and the like. But the second wave, they did magnificent synagogues. If you looked at the old shuls that used to exist, stained glass, beautiful glass and architecture, magnificent buildings on the Lower East Side, even today. See beautiful, beautiful shuls, which most of them are churches today. So the Chesed and the Aveda collapsed. To the extent there is a Kiyum of Torah in America, to some degree, it really is when yeshivas started coming, which was really after World War II. I mean, there were some Torah Vadas. I mean, there were a few before YU. But the growth, but certainly day schools and yeshiva gedolos are after World War II. And that created the notion of dairus, of intergenerational continuity. So the Chafetz Chaim Zahara, that without Torah, Aveda and Chesed just collapse, is 100% emes. Now the emes is, this could be a ha'ara on Torah and Derech Eretz as well. And that is that without that Eish HaTorah, without that Hislavos, then everything else falls apart. So, again, something to think about, and again, that's what Rav Dessler said, that a Torah Derech Eretz is not going to produce Gedolim because you don't have that Hislavos. Okay.
So,
yeah.
So this was another
point Rav Dessler made. I should have been more beferish in this. Rav Dessler tainted that Torah Derech Eretz, he had two chesaron. It's not only a chesaron in the time you're devoting to learning, but he says it would tend, he says it's a generalization, but Rav Dessler says it would tend to produce less of a hislavus for Torah, because when Torah is in competition with other ideas, and those other ideas are given kind of equal billing on some level, so memela, the person's cheshek, the person's connection to Torah becomes less of a strong connection. So Rav Hirsch, so Rav Dessler described Torah Derech Eretz as producing, again, these are generalizations, and if anyone is a product of Torah Derech Eretz, I ask Mechila, because I'm not expressing my own day on anything, I'm just telling you what Rav Dessler writes. Rav Dessler writes, it will tend to produce a person who has less of an emotional feeling for Torah and Yerush Shema, right? So that's going to be part of the problem. Now, if you want to tie in that that's not mukrach, you know, ain't a chinami. Maybe that's so. But it was felt that by and large, when Torah is in competition with other things, the feeling. Now, I want to point out that to the degree you consider modern orthodoxy an outgrowth of Tide, which is Lav Dafka, within modern orthodoxy, this is commonly they themselves are mocker this problem. They'll commonly say, you know, we're keeping mitzvahs, we're following the halacha, well, you can clear about that, but we're following the halacha, but we don't have the geshmak, we don't have the islavos, we don't have, in other words, this is something they themselves identify. As we open ourselves up to all sorts of things, we don't have the bren. So, within the modern Orthodox world, they've identified this as a pagam. And even Rav Hirsch said a beautiful, interesting comment. Rav Hirsch said, the problem, this was in the 19th century, the problem of the modern Jew who tries to live in multiple worlds is he is the reverse of the Muranos of Spain. Right? The Muranos of Spain were Goyim on the outside and Yidden on the inside. We've produced people, Rav Hirsch says, that Baruch Hashem are Yidden on the outside. They wear tefillin, they eat kosher, they keep Shabbos. But inside, what are they? So Rav Hirsch himself was aimed on the fact that there could be a pagam in the panemius of Aveda here. And Rav Dester, you know, noted that before. Yeah.
Even with Rav Hirsch's
Baha'u'llah,
would he advocate how nowadays they advocate his Baha'u'llah?
Well, I would say this. I mean, the one thing Rav Hirsch would not be maskim to, and this is pashut, is he would not be maskim places of pritis, right? He would not be maskim learning courses of kefira, right? So those things Rav Hirsch clearly did have lines. On the other hand, if you're asking me, would Rav Hirsch support the idea of a person who works and goes to Daf Yomi, the answer is that was his typical balabas. I mean, now, you'll get into the shaila of the Chatchilo B'diyevet, but Rav Hirsch did certainly support that type of idea. But as I say, the modern university has also separate issues. Besides the issue of Bittul Taira, the issue of Kfir and the issue of Pritzis, and those issues, Rav Hirsch was very machmer. That he would not,
Well, Rav Hirsch
followed really, which is really a psak in the Shulchan Aruch itself, that if you're not Tairasa Unasai, you should concentrate on Yanu of Halacha Lamaisa. That was Halacha Lamaisa. Plus, as you might expect, he was very big on Tanakh, Chumash, and he felt that that would give you the Hashkafa of how to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But he advocated learning as much as you can, but he understood. Now again, as I say, you could say it's a harasha in Inukhinami, but he did not expect his kehila to be learning all day. That was not the product of his system. Okay. Alrighty, so that's kind of what I wanted to say about Torah of Derech Eretz.
There's like across the world now, there's like in America there's tons of Hebrew academies, and in England there's like more than 50 schools at least that are like on the United Synagogue. They're all throwing Torah in with their Eretz, or they're just under the modern Orthodox brand?
Well,
there's hundreds of thousands as well.
Well, you know, as I say, as I said a few moments ago, whether the movement that is called modern Orthodox, or they call it centrist Orthodox, there are different terms for it, whether that is the Yairesh of Tayrim Derech Eretz is a big, big shaila. I'll tell you why. Whether Rav Hirsch's Shita was Lachatchil or B'diyevin, Rav Hirsch's Shita was something that was very much a discipline and a Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim. And this was his yisayid. Does your makabel omal chashamayim, you know, unconditionally, like the Chazon Ish even said, that kol ruchos shebi'aylam are not going to push you away from Shmiras HaMitzvahs, right? That was his Yesite. Now, with modern Orthodox, it's not so much a Shita. It's not so much a Shita. It's really a, it's lack of a Shita. It's basically a Kalas Reish. So they say, oh, well, we do secular stuff because we're first did secular stuff, but it's not to say, it's really kind of an excuse. I mean, no, depending, mixed swimming, mixed dancing, a lack of tznius in ways that are, you know, I'm not talking about what's called lack of tznius here. That's, I'm talking about, you know, real problems. You know, so, modern, again, I don't mean to generalize, because I mean, there are many modern Orthodox who are Hirschians. But to a large degree, modern Orthodox in America is a synonym for simply not being medaktik in mitzvahs. In other words, you basically say, you know, I'll do two-thirds of things. So mixed swimming is okay, dancing is okay, you know, whatever it is. That has nothing to do with refersh. That's just a certain kalus reish towards avodas Hashem. Well, B'nai Akiva is connected to Zionism, which is really the next topic I want to talk about a little bit. The connection between Zionism and Hirschianism is very interesting, but Hirsch himself was an anti-Zionist in many ways. So we'll just begin this. I'll talk about it maybe, I'll talk about it next week and maybe one session after that, and then I think we'll be able to be Messiah. And that is Zionism. The word Zionism itself is an ambiguous term. Tzionut. Some religious Jews consider it to be almost the most beloved word in the religious vocabulary, and many religious Jews consider it to be the most hated word almost in the religious vocabulary. But let me just mention that there are at least three different versions of Zionism. There is what's called political Zionism. There is what is called cultural Zionism. And there is what you call religious Zionism. And each of them were very, very different shitas. And let me first explain political Zionism. Political Zionism was the Zionism that was created or invented or articulated by Theodor Herzl. Herzl was, again, I'm not here to insult him. I mean, Herzl was in many ways a Tinok Shenishba. Herzl was born into a totally assimilated family. He had no Jewish education at all. He had no background at all. But he became a reporter for an Austrian paper. And as a reporter for an Austrian paper in the 1890s, he was sent to cover a trial in Paris of a former soldier in the French army, Alfred Dreyfus. I'm sure you've heard of the Dreyfus trial. And Dreyfus was accused of espionage, or Dreyfus was accused of being a spy, and he was sentenced to Devil's Island, which was a gefährliche, horrendous place to go, like the French version of Alcatraz, or come out like a concentration camp. And Herzl became convinced, as many observers became convinced, that this was a totally fake, unjustified conviction, and Dreyfus was convicted only because he was Jewish. And this was an example of pure anti-Semitism. And this was a revelation to Herzl, because Herzl didn't understand this. Herzl thought that, you know, he knew he was Jewish, that much he knew, but he thought this was the age of freedom, this was after the French Revolution, people had rights, people had liberties. France, after all, was the first country that granted Jews political rights. Napoleon, right after the French Revolution, then Napoleon, right, granted Jews full civil rights, which is why there were no yeshivas in France, but they could do what they want. And all of a sudden, at the end of the 19th century, 100 years after the French Revolution, 100 years, this vicious anti-Semitism all of a sudden gets recreated. Right? So we would say, Halacha, Esav Sayne the Yaakov. But Herzl didn't know any Gemara. So Herzl didn't understand this, and this was really something that bothered him a lot. And I have to say, I mean, in some ways his heart was in a good place. And he thought, if only Jews would have a country, would have a nation, would have a place like all other nations, the world would stop hating us. There would be normalization. We would be kechol hagoyim. His etza was, if we are kechol hagoyim, right? We know what the mistake is, but his sheet was, if we are kechol hagoyim, then they will accept us. They will respect us. So Herzl's vision of a Jewish state was essentially a desire to achieve normalization, and he saw this as a refuah for anti-Semitism. In other words, he saw anti-Semitism as a real problem. People want to kill us. So let's be Kachal HaGoyim, let's have a nation. Right? Now, it was not a religious vision. It was a practical vision. Now, because of this, again, Lishitasai, it was quite logical, where it didn't have to be Israel. It didn't have to be Palestine, as it was called then. The Ikar is Jews have a state. Good. Now, granted, most of the people that he was getting around his cause had some connection to Eretz Yisrael, so they wanted Eretz Yisrael. But Herzl said it's loved after Eretz Yisrael. As you know, Eretz Yisrael at the time was under the rule of the Ottoman Empire, right, which had been ruling Eretz Yisrael for 500 years or so. And the Ottoman Emperor didn't want to give up Palestine at the time, etc. So there was some talk about Uganda. And Herzl was willing to even accept Uganda. There was even a proposal for Galveston Island. I don't know how many Jews could fit on Galveston Island. You know, Galveston, Texas is on an island which is now filled into the mainland. But there was a proposal that the United States might give up Galveston Island as a Jewish state. I mean, not too many Jews, certainly you couldn't have 6 million Jews in Galveston Island, but okay. Even Stalin in his generosity at some point was willing to give up a part of Georgia in the Soviet Union, for a Jewish state. Unfortunately, one state over, Siberia, became de facto the Jewish state, but be it as it may. So that was Herzl. Now, Herzl thought that political independence would create normalization, and normalization would be a cure for anti-Semitism. Now, without even getting into the religious part of this, if we ask ourselves, was that right or wrong? I mean, just asking a simple question. Is the establishment of the State of Israel, has that reduced the amount of anti-Semitism in the world? Pashut, you see that Herzl was wrong. If anything, the establishment of the State of Israel has increased the hatred of the Jewish people in many places. Again, I'm not justifiably so, but Lemaisa, accusing Israel of apartheid, accusing them of being not, the term Nazi is often applied. Yeah. And I don't mean, by the way, I don't mean the totally repulsive use of Haredim calling the Israelis Nazis. That happened 2 weeks ago. That's beyond contempt in many ways. But I'm talking about, but the Goyim are calling, Goyim often referred to the State of Israel as a Nazi regime. Yeah.
Is it possible that the anti-Semitism has grown due to the State of Israel because of the policies of Israeli governments, but that's not necessarily what Herzl had in mind?
Well, it's a good question. There were a lot of things. Now, Herzl did write a book envisioning what a Jewish state would be like. It's called The Jewish State. Although there's machlokas how to translate it. It was written in German. It might either mean the Jewish state or the state of the Jews. There actually is a nafkamina. The Jewish state has a mashmos that the state should have some Jewish tam. State of the Jews says Jews live here. There's actually a machlokas. They're arguing over what's the exact translation of the German, and they say they're nafkaminas. But a lot of things Herzl didn't deal with much. In other words, he did not really deal with what do you do about the Arabs that happen to be living here? I mean, this is a, forget about Frumkai, I mean, this is a real question. And he kind of said, well, we'll get along somehow. He really did not address that prat, which indeed might be on the other hand, it's almost a psik ratio that's going to be a source. One famous remark in the Jewish state, or the state of the Jews, that Herzl said, because he did talk about the role of religion in his political state, and he said, well, of course, people should have freedom of religion. People, if they want to be religious, let them be religious. But he said, we shall confine the rabbis to their synagogues. Yeshiva, he didn't even know what yeshiva was. He said, we shall confine the rabbis to their synagogues. just as we will confine the soldiers to their barracks. Well, he actually made a hekesh, but he didn't know which way the hekesh goes, you know, because kishem, right, he's makesh, rabbanim to soldiers. But the other way, kishem that the soldiers, unfortunately, don't stay in the barracks, you know, the rabbis don't stay in the synagogue, you know, but he basically said that, you know, he looked at religion as a kayach that would only be shaykh to yechidim do it, etc. And by the way, this was, we'll talk more about this, but this was Ben-Gurion too. You know, in 1948, Ben-Gurion came to an agreement with Agudas Yisrael and the other from people in the government that they would not draft B'nai Torah. Right? That's why you guys aren't, well, not you guys, whoever is an Oleh, an Israeli citizen, is not in the army because of the 1948 agreement with Ben-Gurion. Now, at the time, in Eretz Yisrael, there were only around 500 people who were learning. And Ben-Gurion was so batuach that number would just get lower and lower and lower and lower and it would disappear in 20 years, that he had no problem with being maskim to this, because he figured it was a mashahu, it would be batal, and it would have no significance whatsoever. He thought it would be a private thing that would just wither away as we enter the 20th century and go weiter and we progress more and more. Little did he know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a different plan for things. And we have to say, Ben-Gurion Mustama would have had, and did have karata over agreeing to this, giving this away that way. And that's why, as you know, one of the big pressure points in this Israeli society is whether, you know, whether to continue the exemption. This is a big, this is a constant issue, a constant nisayan that B'nai Torah are going to face over and over and over and over and over again. Because as the numbers K-Yirbu grow larger, the pressures to take away the exemption also grow larger. That's why you have Nachal Peri Di and everything else. Yeah.
Do you feel that Nachal Peri Di is an answer?
Well, when you say it's an answer, in other words, is it an answer that will placate? In other words, an answer to what? In other words,
does it make sense for Haredim to go to Nachal Peri Di, and in that way, maybe be able to vote?
Well, maybe we'll save that. I mean, that's a difficult question. I think looking at it in terms of the tayelas for the individual bachur or the individual person, sometimes it may be a tayelas. If you have a guy like who's not learning, who's hanging around and kind of wasting time, it could be a certain maskeres of a military service that allows him to be shomer Torah mitzvahs might be a good mahalach, but I don't think we would advocate it for as a klal that should normally be pursued. And again, I have to say I don't know enough about the ins and the outs. Meaning, in order for Nachal Charedi to be accepted, you know, you have to be talking about, you know, a place where, you know, the person keeps halacha, the person has time to be kavei itum l'Torah. The person is not exposed to preaches. And you see that the army is not as cooperative as you think. I mean, what is this business about, you know, you got to sit, I mean, what, you know, these soldiers get disciplined because they don't want to listen to a woman singing. I mean, like, what does it have to do? And they said, you know, you will not be able to, you know, religious law will not let you get out of this. Like, this has nothing to do with the military mission at all. Yeah.
Besides from the firmness issue with going to the army, when the chilonim come and say, you know, I understand if all the people in yeshiva who are actually learning don't go to the army, but you see that there's thousands of boys who are just wasting their time and using yeshiva as an excuse. Do they have a right to say that, or can you turn back and say, who said you have a right to make me go to the army?
Okay, we're finished. I mean, I do want to talk about that. In other words, your question is the following idea. In other words, you're raising a chakir, which is a good chakir. Is it the pshat, and this depends, if the pshat is that it's proper to have a Jewish state and it's proper to have an army, elamai, people who are learning should be putter, then it would turn out that those who are not learning should go. Right? That if, on the other hand, your hashkafa is that the whole enterprise is not a proper enterprise, then whether you're learning or not, you shouldn't go, because it's not anything that you should be machshiv and the like, right? So in many ways, your hashkafa on the Medina is going to determine your answer to that.
And then there's the question in regards to that, do I have a right to say that I'm still living?
Well, that's a good question. On the other hand, I'll tell you, you know, the Ran says in Maseches Nedarim, and many people are sabach in this halacha l'maisa, although I'm not sabach in the halacha l'maisa, that Dina de Malchusa Dina does not apply in Eretz Yisrael. And the Ran says in the Dorian, because in any other country in the world, if you don't accept the laws, they could kick you out. So if you live in the United States, you are makabel on yourself those laws. In Eretz Yisrael, every Yid has the right to live. So the fact that you're living here, Zakhtaran, doesn't mean that you're makabel those laws, because they don't have the right to kick you out. Now, Agrada, please note, the Ran is talking about a Geisha government, right? The Ran is not talking about directly this government, but many poskim take the Ran and they apply it. So the Ran says, Beferish, that no government can tell a Jew, al pi halacha, get out of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, your living here is not automatically a kabbalah of those laws. But we'll talk about it. I mean, you're raising a good question, because if one questions the whole legitimacy of things, then you don't need the patur of Talmud Torah. Stamazah, you're not mechayiv to go. But if you accept the basic legitimacy of the arrangement, then it's a patur of Talmud Torah, and then you have to have that patur. Otherwise, you should go. Okay, just like Moshe Rabbeinu said to Bnei Gad of Bnei Reuben, right? If your brethren are going to war, you know, you have to go. Okay, we'll be mamshich next week.
Why did the Rambam translate the Tzaddik himself?
Why didn't you?